Okay, so today is the great Vaisak day, the most important day of the Buddhist year. And of course, you probably all know already, this is a celebration of the birth, the awakening or the enlightenment of the Buddha, and also the final passing away of the Buddha. This is what this day is all about. As usual, because this is a celebration of the Buddha in a sense, by celebrating the Buddha, we are of course also celebrating the Dhamma. But because it is a celebration of the Buddha, it's a time to reflect on the life of the Buddha. And that is what I'm going to do today. It's a kind of tradition, and I quite like it. I think it's a very nice thing to do anyway. What I want to focus on today is what I would call the real Buddha. Who actually was this person that existed 2,500 years ago? And to actually try to find the reality from all the myth, from all the legend that has arisen later on. So we can actually get a feeling here for who this person was that existed 2,500 years ago. And there are some very interesting things that arise when you start to look at the reality of things. And these are the points that I want to maybe point out today. And one of the things that arises when you start to look at who the real Buddha was is that he was a human being just like the rest of us. He wasn't some kind of god or some kind of indefinable something, but he was a human being that existed here on this planet just like we exist here today. And what that means for me, when you realize that Buddha was a human being, you realize that his life story, the way he lived his life, how he overcame suffering, how he found the highest happiness, his life story is very, very relevant to us. Because just as he was able to find the end of suffering, just as he was able to find the highest happiness in the world, so we can do exactly the same. If the Buddha could do it, he was a human being, we can also do it. So that means that when we hear the story of the Buddha, it has immense relevance for us. It's not just a story as such, which is nice to hear, but it's something that we can apply directly in our own lives, something that we can gain inspiration from, and we can use for ourselves to practice better, to be better Buddhist, and do the right thing, which lead to happiness for ourselves and also all the people that we get in contact with. So that is the first thing. And I actually find it much more inspiring to have a Buddha who is like a fellow human being and to think of the Buddha as something completely unapproachable, something beyond the ordinary human sphere. So that is the first thing here. The second thing, of course, is that Buddha also was exceptional in certain ways. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been the Buddha. He's not obviously not just a human being. But what you will find when you read and you understand the Buddha's life story as it actually was, what was exceptional about him was that he had very powerful spiritual qualities. He was a human being with exceptionally powerful mental and spiritual qualities. Now, the good thing about these spiritual qualities, they are something we can develop. We can actually produce these things in our own mind. These are things that we can actually establish for ourselves by the right practice. So again, the Buddha becomes more of an example, more of something to emulate, rather than something just to look up to with awe and something extra supernatural, if you like. So how do we start off on this looking for the Buddha's life story? And the way I like to start off is to look at some of the things which happened even before the Buddha was born into this world. You may have heard that there's often all these stories about the Buddha's past lives. And the interesting thing is that the Buddha himself sometimes talked about himself and who he was before he actually became the Buddha, before he got into this existence. And these stories, what they show us, they give us a very clear indication of who this person who was born into this world of ours 2,500 years ago, who he was. We get a much better understanding of who this person was. One of these stories is a story the Buddha talks about when he was a wheelwright. A wheelwright is somebody who produces wheels. And he was a producer of wheels also for the local king at this time. This is obviously a long, long time ago, many, many lifetimes ago. This is the story that Buddha talks about himself. And the king says, I need a new pair of wheels for my chariot. Can you produce, please produce a new pair of wheels for me here? And of course, the wheelwright, being asked by the king, says, yes, your majesty, I will produce those wheels for you. And after 7 months, he has produced one wheel. And the king comes to him and he says, I need those pair of wheels in 7 days' time. Are you able to finish the second wheel in 7 days' time? And the Buddha-to-be, the future Buddha, says, yes, I can finish the second wheel in 7 days' time. So after 7 days, the king comes back again to see if both his wheels are ready, if both finished. And sure enough, there they are finished. But then the king is very curious. How come it takes 7 months to produce one wheel and only 7 days to produce the other one? What is the difference between these wheels? Good question, isn't it? And the wheelwright, the Buddha-to-be, he wants to show the king what the difference is. And the difference is, he says, watch what happens when I roll these wheels out along. So he takes the wheel that has taken 7 months to make, and he rolls it out. And when his wheel stops, it stands upright. It doesn't go anywhere. And he takes the second wheel, and he rolls it out. When it stops, it falls over. And the king says, how come one of the wheels stands up and one of the wheels falls over? It's a very simple story here. And the Buddha says, not the Buddha, the future Buddha says that, well, the difference is that in one of the wheels I have taken enormous care finding the right wood, straightening the wood out, making sure there are no knots and no problems in the wood. That is why the first wheel is so perfect, because I've taken enormous, gone to enormous lengths to make it an absolutely perfect wheel. With the second wheel, because I only had 7 days, I didn't have time to use the best of wood. I didn't have time to make it perfect. And because the wood isn't perfect, because it's not perfectly balanced, when it comes to the end of the runway, so to speak, it falls over to its side. What is the point of this story? The point of this story is, first of all, I'd like you to reflect and think about this. The Buddha is a wheelwright. The wheelwright, somebody who produces wheels, is a very kind of low position in Indian society. It's a very, very simple position. It's nothing, something high. And he's working for the king, and he calls the king, Your Majesty. So what does this mean for us? It means that even the Buddha in a past life was a very ordinary person. There was nothing special about him. He didn't have a high social position. He didn't have any massive income. He didn't have all these worldly things that we're all seeking for. He was an ordinary, simple person. And it means that whoever we are in this life, whether we are simple, whether we have a small or a high income, whether we have a little education or lots of education, whatever it is, high social position, low social position, we all have the opportunity to practice the Dhamma. We all have the opportunity to go the right way. The Buddha himself was an extremely simple man in some of his past lives. And to me, this is very inspiring, because it means that this is not what is really important in life. It's not our position. It's not all these external things. What is really important, rather, is the spiritual qualities. And of course, when you realize that somebody takes 7 months to produce a wheel like that, it shows you some of the qualities of this person who does that. There's a quality of perseverance, the quality of seeking for perfection in something, trying your best, always doing your utmost, putting investigation into things, trying to find out how you can make the best possible wheel, mindfulness and concentration, wisdom. You can actually see already there, all those qualities must be there to enable you to actually produce something of such high quality. So this is what the Buddha is. He is an ordinary person in many ways, but he has exceptionally powerful spiritual qualities. And that is really the morale of that story. So that is the first of the Buddha's past life that the Buddha talked about. The second one is another very famous story, which you may have heard before, but I want to repeat it again, because it is also a very beautiful and powerful story. This is a time when the Buddha-to-be, he's not the Buddha yet, he is about to become the Buddha, he was existing and living under the previous Buddha, the Buddha Kassapa. And he was a man, he was a Brahmin called Jyotipala at this time. He had a friend, and his friend was called Gatikara. Now this friend was a very special friend, because this friend was a chief disciple of this Buddha Kassapa. And not only was he the chief disciple of the Buddha Kassapa, but he also had enormous amounts of very, very good meditation. And he had attained something very powerful. Thank you very much. He had gone to the point of becoming what we call a non-returner, an anagami, somebody who has completely destroyed anger and desire within themselves. This was how far this disciple of this Buddha Kassapa had gone. So he was an extraordinary layperson. In fact, he had gone as close to enlightenment as you possibly can without becoming fully enlightened yourself. A very, very powerful person. And then he went to his friend Dhotipala. Dhotipala, right? He is the Buddha to be, our Buddha to be. And he says to his friend Dhotipala, please come with me and visit the Buddha Kassapa, because the Buddha Kassapa is such an exceptional, wonderful being. You will gain a lot from actually visiting him. And Dhotipala says, no, what's the point of seeing these shaven-headed recluses? And if you understand here what is going on here, the Pali for like shaven headed recluse is really a bit of a put down. He's putting down the Buddha. Now here is the Buddha to be, and he's putting down the existing Buddha as it is already. And that is quite extraordinary. He doesn't really understand what the Dhamma is. He doesn't really understand what the Buddha is. He puts it down because of that lack of understanding. So again, it means that there's hope for lots of people in the world. And of course, his friend Gatikara, he is not going to give up so easily. So the next thing he does, he says, he grabs him by the belt and tries to pull him along to the Buddha Kassapa, very persistent. And again, Dhotipala refuses. No, I don't want to see this shaven-headed recluse. Eventually, what happens is that they go down to the river, they have a bath together, and as the bath is finished, they have sort of washed their hair, and they have done all these rituals which are supposed to be done in India. Then Gatikara, he grabs the Brahmin who has just washed his hair, which is a very important ritual for these Brahmins. He grabs him by the hair and starts to pull him along in the right direction. And then Dhotipala says, okay, relax a little bit, maybe. Then he understands the severity of the situation, because this is a big taboo in India. You don't grab a Brahmin by the hair if you are from a lower caste. I'm sure that could probably result in a death penalty in those days. But because they are good friends, he can still do it and get away with it. So then he realized there must be something here which is worthwhile doing. So he said, okay, if you are willing to go this far for me to see this Buddha Kassapa, then I will accept your invitation and I will come along with you. But the point here is that you can see the reluctance here, the enormous reluctance, almost the putting down of somebody who was fully enlightened. But then, of course, when he then goes to see the Buddha Kassapa, then he realizes that this Buddha is somebody very exceptional. The Buddha gives him a teaching, and once he hears that teaching, he decides, I want to become a monk under the Buddha Kassapa. And then he ordains, and he does become a monk under this previous Buddha. So again, the morale here, the point of this story, is to show that the Buddha was not somebody exceptional, extraordinary. He wasn't somebody who had been practicing through eons, always ordaining under Buddhas every single time, trying to perfect himself absolutely. He didn't even understand who a Buddha was. He wasn't even able to tell that his own friend Gatikara was somebody with exceptional qualities, somebody who was an anagami, somebody who had almost become fully enlightened. And this is, again, is very useful for us. But then, of course, once he actually did see the Buddha, he met the Buddha, once he came across the Dhamma properly, then, because of his spiritual qualities, he understood this is the real way. This is the true path. This is the teaching that I have to follow. So again, you can see the mixture there of an ordinary person together with spiritual qualities. Then there is the last story from, it's also again from the suttas. This is a sutta in the Digha Nikaya called the Mahasuddhasana Sutta. And this is a little bit more kind of legendary type of sutta, but it's still quite inspiring, and I still like it because it shows us some of the powers of this person who is about to become the Buddha soon, in the not too distant future. And this is a life before he became the Buddha, this man who was to become the Buddha, was extremely powerful, a king in an extraordinarily wealthy country. He ruled a massive and vast swaths of land. He was extraordinarily wealthy. He had everything that you can think of, that you can want as a human being. He had wealth, he had possessions, he had palaces, he had gold and silver, he had lots of wives, as was the custom in those days. And he had, not only did he have all the material possessions you can wish for, but he also had the fame, of course, massive fame, because everybody loved this king, because he was also a very nice king, a very beautiful person. So when he went out into the countryside to meet his subjects, the people that were under him, they would look up to him as a father, because he was such a good person, such a powerful king, with a very good heart. They'd look up to him as a father figure. And he would look at all his subjects in the country as sons and daughters, because he loved all his subjects, and he tried to do the best for all his subjects. So he was famous. He had the love and respect of his countrymen, of all the people around him. He was praised by everybody. He was powerful. He was wealthy. He had everything that anybody in this world ever wants, and to a very, very large extent. He had so much of it that any one of us can never dream of acquiring anything even remotely like that. We are striving for all these things. He had much more. And what does he do, having so much of this? He decides that when he comes to a certain point in life, I'm going to give all this up. I'm going to relinquish it all to my sons, so they can start rule the country instead. And what am I going to do? I'm going to meditate. I'm going to withdraw and search for the happiness in the mind, which is much more powerful, much more useful, and much more interesting than all of these worldly attachments, all this material well-being, all the fame, all the praise, all the love of the world is not worth a fraction of the happiness in meditation. And that's what he does. And then, of course, because he then gains very deep states of meditation, he ends up being reborn later on into a very, very happy existence, much more happy than any human realm. And again, it shows you here, it shows you the spiritual qualities of somebody who is to become the Buddha in the future. He understands the reality of things. He understands where true happiness is to be found. And even though the whole country would have been against it, even though the whole country would say, please, don't renounce, please stay on as king, we love you too much, he was independent and powerful enough to say, whatever anybody else says, I know where the real happiness is to be found, and I have to follow that real happiness in my life. It was a very wise and very deep understanding here in this person who wants to become the Buddha. And of course, when we reflect on this, we realize that in our own lives, we have to find a sense of proportion in our lives. We have to understand the limitations of searching for worldly happiness, because the worldly happiness only goes so far. And even when you reach the absolute pinnacle, the absolute maximum of worldly happiness, it is still worth renouncing for something much more profound. And when you realize that, you don't give up all your worldly things. That's not what you do. But what you do is you change your priorities a little bit. And you move towards spiritual happiness a little bit more. You do a little bit more charity work in the world. You do a little bit more keeping the precepts. Maybe even you go so far as to try a little bit of meditation practice. And when you do that, you're moving in the right direction. And that is what this example means. That ultimately, at the end of the day, if you want real contentment and happiness in your life, this is what you're going to have to do. So this then is the man that 2,500 years ago, this is his background, this is who he was, and this is the man that was born into our planet, the Earth, 2,500 years ago. He was a man of flesh and blood. He was a man of weaknesses and strengths, just like us. But he had some very powerful spiritual faculties. And then, when he was born into the present existence 2,500 years ago, then of course we all know parts of that story. He was born into a family that was well off. He was not born into royalty or anything like that, but it was a well-off family. And he had all the pleasures that people at that time usually would want. He had the best clothes, best kind of food. He says he had three houses, one for the winter season, one for the summer season, and one for the rainy season. So he had all the pleasures in life that people usually desire and usually want. He was also born into a high caste, so a powerful position in society. So it wasn't anything fabulous, as you may sometimes think it was. The Buddha himself said this was what he had when he was born into the present existence. And then, of course, after a while, having lived a good and happy life, the Buddha starts to realize that there is more to life than just these happinesses around here. There is also problems in life. And when the Buddha reflected on his own life, he realized that the things which are problematic in life are things like death, suffering, defilements, old age and illness. These are the big problems in life. And how did the Buddha reflect on these things? It's quite fascinating just to understand how he reflected on these things. Take death, for example. What did the Buddha say about death? He said that it's common for us, when we go about our daily lives, when we do our ordinary things, our ordinary duties, when we enjoy ourselves, we tend to forget that there is such a thing as death. We tend to forget that this suffering even exists very often. But here, what the Buddha did instead, as soon as he realized that there is such a thing as death in the world, that there is a serious problem here, then he understood that you cannot just be heedless anymore. You cannot just go around and pretend that death doesn't exist. This death has extraordinarily powerful consequences for us. And the consequences are, we are going to have to try to find a solution to this problem. How can you just indulge yourself? How can you just have a good time when you realize at the end of this existence you are going to have to suffer for the consequences of that? How can you keep attaching yourself to all kinds of things more and more powerfully when at the end of your life it's all going to be pulled apart from you, pulled away from you, and then you're going to suffer accordingly? And that is what the Buddha saw. And this, again, of course, is a beautiful inspiration for us to realize, to remember the sufferings in life and the problems in life, and realize the way of dealing with these problems is to do a certain amount of spiritual practice. Any kind of spiritual practice you do, whether it's just generosity or morality or whatever it is, all of this is going to help you overcoming these kind of problems in life. So there is the problems of death would be less if you had practiced in a good way in this life. And this is what the Buddha saw. But of course, for the Buddha, it had very powerful consequences. When he saw death, when he saw, and the other thing which he saw was interesting, he saw defilements. He says in the sutta that I myself am subject to defilement. What this means is that even the Buddha's mind, he himself occasionally would have thoughts of ill will and negativity in his mind. He also had desires in his mind. Otherwise, he wouldn't have said that I'm subject to defilement. And in fact, later on, you will read suttas where the Buddha deliberately categorizes his own thoughts in two camps. On the one hand, the thoughts which are defiled and bad, like sensuality and anger and ill will. And on the other hand, the pure thoughts of loving kindness and compassion and renunciation. So even the Buddha had a mind where there were certain defilements. And again, it's wonderful to know that even the most spiritually advanced person on this planet, even he had defilements in his mind. It makes us not feel so bad when sometimes we get upset and angry, when we know that even the Buddha was this way. So the point of the Buddhist practice is not to feel guilty about things when something happens in your mind. The purpose of the practice is rather to try to lessen them, because we know that ultimately there is some suffering connected with being angry, with negativity. There's suffering for us and also for the people around us. So never get upset about your own upsetness, because that just makes the whole issue much worse. Instead, reflect, what can I do to maybe improve myself in a certain way, just as the Buddha improved himself and overcame his own defilement to become fully enlightened and awakened. Then the Buddha reflected, this home life, it's not easy to live the home life in such a way that I can be fully and perfectly purify myself. It is difficult. And because it is difficult, I'm going to have to give up for the home life and instead renounce and become a monk and travel around India and do what a monk has to do to purify myself. So this was the other thought. So he took this thought of suffering in life to an extreme, to the extent when he gave up everything that he had in his life. And then there is a small but interesting episode in the Buddha's life which most people are not aware of, even those of you who have read the life story of the Buddha. Then he actually went to his parents and he said, Mother and Father, I wish to renounce this existence and I wish to leave and become a monk because I've seen the problems in life. The standard story that we hear about the Buddha is that he left in the middle of the night, left child and wife behind. And when you think about it, it sounds irresponsible, doesn't it? It doesn't sound quite right to do that. And of course, the reason why we are able to forgive it usually is because he was the Buddha. He was somebody special. He wasn't quite like us. And that's why we tend to forgive it. But the reality is that the Buddha says himself in the sutta that when I left, my mother and father were crying and they wished otherwise that I wouldn't leave. Now, the only way that they could be crying and wishing otherwise was because he had consulted with them. He had said to them that I desire to leave this existence of the home life and want to become a monk. So it's a beautiful, it's actually, from my opinion, it's much more beautiful to read the sutta in this way. And because it means that the Buddha had a sense of responsibility there. Responsibility for his loved ones, for his family, for everybody else. And he sought their permission, basically, before he went off and became a renunciate. And of course, like any responsible parent, we have to assume that the parent said, of course, yes, we don't want you to do this. We don't desire it because we love you so much. And you can imagine how much attachment you would have to a son like the Buddha who was so exceptional. Very powerful attachment, no doubt. And yet, they also probably realized that the son was very special, that he had some very special powers and understanding and insights. And because they felt that he was doing the responsible thing, they said, okay, you must do what you feel is right. We cannot hold you back. So even though we wish otherwise, you have to do what you feel is right. And this is the kind of line I think that any responsible parent should have towards their children. We should look and see what our children want. And if we feel that our children understand, they have enough wisdom to make the right and good choices in the world, that they have an understanding, the difference between right and wrong in the world, then ultimately, if what they want to do, we have to sort of allow them to follow their own heart, their own desires, what seems right to them, as long as we're satisfied that they do things responsibly and in the right way. So this is another example here to show us how to deal with these kinds of situations. Then the Buddha goes off and he leaves the home life. And the first thing he does after leaving the home life is to seek teachers. He seeks somebody who can show him something that he does not already know. And again, here is somebody who has the spiritual maturity to leave the whole world behind. Somebody with very powerful spiritual faculties. And yet, he seeks help from other people. And it's important to understand this. There is no contradiction between spiritual maturity. There's no contradiction between having confidence in yourself, so much confidence that you're willing to leave the whole world behind, and yet also being humble enough to seek advice and seek understanding somewhere else. In fact, humility and confidence go together. If you are really confident in yourself, you will welcome other people's advice because you know that you can grow from other people's advice. You know that there are people out there who know much more than you. And because there are people who know much more than you, you will accept the advice that you can get from outside. It's a bit like going to school or going to university. The reason we do that is because we know that there are professors in all kinds of fields who know more than we do. And we are willing to accept their advice. And it's exactly the same thing in the spiritual field. It's important to be open enough to accept the advice and the understanding that other people may have. And of course, the ultimate advice that we have, the final advice, the final authority in our lives is always going to be the Buddha himself. That is where we should seek that advice as Buddhists. So the Buddha here, actually it's not the Buddha yet, he's still before he's the Buddha. He is humble enough to go out and seek this advice from people around him who may know more than he does. then he follows that advice, he practices accordingly in exactly the way that they prescribe, and then he attains those things that these people say that should be attained in the world. But then, of course, he understands that even this practice does not lead to the final end of suffering. So then his confidence comes back and says, well, I've tried this, it doesn't work out, and because it doesn't work out, I'm going to have to seek the path of enlightenment for myself, because these people have not understood ultimately what is the complete end of suffering. So then the Buddha goes off on his own and now seeks awakening, seeks an end of suffering all by himself. And of course, I'm sure that many of you will know the story. He goes off, and what he does, he seeks to find the end of suffering by mortifying the body, by going through extreme tormenting of the body, until the point where he's almost on the border of death. And when he knows that he cannot go any further because he's about to die, then he has to give up also the idea of self-mortification as a path to awakening. And at this point, he reflects, well, I've given up the home life. I've given up the indulgence in sensual pleasures because that does not lead to awakening. I have given up trying to torture the body because that does not lead to awakening. So what should I do next? Is there any other way to awakening? And this is the point at which the Buddha realizes that the right way to awakening is finding that deep stillness in meditation practice, because that empowers the mind, gives the mind this extreme power, stillness, clarity, all these beautiful qualities that make it possible to penetrate to the most difficult and hard aspects of reality. And this is maybe the most important realization in the Buddha's, the pre-Buddha's life, before he becomes the Buddha. He understands where the path is. And this, of course, later on becomes known as the middle way between torture, making things painful for yourself, and overindulgence. And this middle way is something we can use for ourselves when we practice meditation. Remember not to torture your body when you sit. There's no point in having overly discomfort, because your mind is just going to be preoccupied with the discomfort. And also don't overly indulge yourself. Don't lie down on the big waterbed, because you're going to end up maybe falling asleep, or you're going to end up just enjoying just lying there rather than being able to watch the breath or do loving kindness or whatever. So find that beautiful middle way where you're comfortable but not indulging yourself. Because this was a middle way that the Buddha discovered for us for the benefit of all of us. And even in his interesting actually, because even in monastic life you sometimes find, I found sometimes monks who practice too hard, they're too tough. And you would think that there was some kind of, sometimes they go over the top and they actually end up hurting themselves. And sometimes they end up disrobing because it becomes too hard. And the pain in the body becomes so difficult to overcome that the mind also gets dragged down by the pain in the body. And that is the problem with mortifying yourself, having too much pain, that it also affects the mind. It drags you down. You cannot get that clarity that you're seeking for. The Buddha then realizes, and then he starts, he thinks for himself, well, what should I do? What should I do? And the first thing he says, because he has decided to end the path of self-mortification, of hurting himself, let me start by eating properly here, because he was completely thin and emaciated at this point. So he starts eating properly. Then he goes off, and he eventually goes wandering around, and he finds a place which is suitable for meditation. Now, what is that place which is suitable for meditation? It is a beautiful forest grove with a beautifully flowing river, with beautiful banks where he can bathe when required, where he can sit down in the peaceful, shady trees in a beautiful place for himself. And then there is also a village nearby where he can go for his alms food. And again, you see here that what the Buddha is doing, he's practicing at this point already the middle way. He doesn't go to a place which is extremely difficult, in a jungle far away. He goes to a place which is pleasant, which is beautiful, beautiful nature, beautiful and easy access to food, easy access to the necessities of life which are required for us to even just survive. And so this is how the Buddha practiced. And if you start reading the suttas, you start reading what other monks say about nature, for example, and nuns would say about nature, they would often praise natural beauty. They would praise nature in a way which makes it clear that beautiful nature around you is not usually a hindrance on the path. It is something which is required to find that right balance, to feel at ease and feel peaceful. It is the sensual life which is the problem. So the Buddha, again, is following that middle path. Then, I'm just going to go on for a few bits more and open up for questions. Having discovered that this is the way, then he practices those deep states of meditation, finds the profound peacefulness and calm inside of himself. And then the first thing he does, once he has achieved that calm, he goes to the recollection of his own past lives. This is probably also something you already know from the suttas. Why does the Buddha recall his past lives? And the reason, of course, is that the Buddha, he grew up in a society where this was a standard way of thinking about life. Everybody believed in reincarnation. Everybody believed in past lives and in future lives. But the point here is that the Buddha is not satisfied with just believing. The Buddha just doesn't accept that this is the case. He has to investigate this for himself. He has to turn his mind, his powerful mind, towards whether this actually is the case. And then, of course, he does that, and he does recall his past lives, and he sees that there is such a thing as reincarnation, as rebirth. This exists, not just a figment of the imagination, it's not just a cultural belief, it is part of the makeup of the universe, that there is such a thing as going around from birth to birth, again and again and again. And, of course, what the Buddha is showing here, he's showing us the importance of investigation. Don't take things on board just because you hear about it. Don't even take Buddhist things on board just because you hear about it, but investigate these things. And the Buddha, again, being the leader, being the prime example on how we should go about always investigating, always trying to understand things in a rational proper way, rather than just taking on board beliefs. So Buddha himself would investigate. And the next thing, of course, that he does, when he sees all these rebirths, the powerful consequence of seeing rebirth is that you get this sense of, you don't want this anymore. This is pointless. Going around, being born again and again, doing the same thing in life after life, having the same kind of suffering every time you get reborn, sometimes worse, sometimes better, it all becomes so pointless. And of course, this is a kind of powerful insight which leads you to want to become fully enlightened, to awaken completely. Next thing he does is to understand the law of karma, to find out what is the mechanism, how is it that we get reborn in the first place. And he finds that the mechanism which leads to rebirth is the law of karma. An impersonal law has got nothing to do with us, that works in its own way, sometimes leading us up, sometimes leading us down. Without us really being able to choose, without us being in charge of our own destination. And when you see that there is such an impersonal law which runs you, which drives you from one existence to another one, sometimes suffering, sometimes happiness, it becomes a bit disconcerting. It becomes almost a bit frightening in a sense, because you have no choice at the end of the day whether you're going to be happy, whether you're going to suffer. These things will happen to you, whether you want to or not. You are not in charge. It's an impersonal law of the universe. And of course, having understood this, the Buddha is unable to turn his mind to the ending of all these problems. And that is when he attains his final awakening, his final understanding, his enlightenment experience, which is the ending of all this thing we call rebirth, which is the attainment of the highest possible happiness in this life, the attainment of Nibbana itself. And that is what the Buddha realized, the end of all defilements, the end of all problems, the end of all suffering. So, my purpose here today is to show you the Buddha. Basically, he was an ordinary person. When you read what the suttas, what the Buddha himself says about himself, And we have to remember that the final authority in anything in this life of a Buddhist is what the Buddha said. When we see what the Buddha himself said, it becomes quite clear that he was an ordinary person with suffering, with defilements, with problems, just like the rest of us. But the inspiration of the Buddha is that he developed his own spiritual faculties very highly. And because spiritual faculties is something everybody can develop, all we have to do is follow the Buddhist example, practice these spiritual faculties ourselves, and develop us in the same way. And then we too can slowly but surely move in the same direction. Eventually, we also can become enlightened. So that is the talk this morning.
Sadhu, sadhu. Okay, we'd like to open up for questions from the floor. And while you're still thinking about the question, just want to ask you whether you read the papers this morning? Not yet. Oh, right. Gongming San was featured on the front page of the Straits Times, which is indeed a big leap, yeah, for Buddhism, because in the past, you know, it's not always on the front page, or maybe they'll show some people lighting candles or something. But today they had this picture of Kuangsheng, Venerable Kuangsheng, who's our spiritual patron as well, leading the Three Steps, One Dao. And I think it's indeed a very skillful way of bringing people into Buddhism as well, because not everybody can sit quietly and meditate. A lot of people need to do something, right? So Three Steps, One Dao is good, and chanting is good, but what's even better is to follow the Buddha's sit down and do nothing, meditate. But we know that's hard. But whenever we do chanting, let's be mindful that it's actually recollecting the teachings that are there. It's not just chanting for the sake of chanting, but internalizing what we chant so that we truly absorb the words and put it into our practice. So I'd like to open the floor now for questions. Any question is welcome, as Ajahn Brahmali said. Do inquire. Yes.
Good morning, Ajahn. You mentioned earlier that as Buddhists, we should always do a lot of questioning. And you also mentioned that we have to just do not take it, and then we have to question. And this question about looking the past life of Buddha, or before he became Buddha. So do you think as lay people, we should also look into our past lives in order to understand samsara? Thank you.
If you can, great. You know. Go for it. It's not that easy, though, unfortunately. You know, ideally, yes, you should. But it's not going to be like, you know, something you can do straight away here. But if you do practice properly, you do the right thing, the day may come when you can actually see your own past lives. That would be a very powerful, I'm sure that would be an extraordinarily powerful experience for you if you saw that. So, yes, you should, and you should inquire, but it's also important in Buddhism that there's always a balance between faith and inquiry, you know? So if you feel that you have enough faith to practice properly, do the right thing, you don't have to inquire for inquiry's sake. If you feel that, you know, you already are, you know, you have enough faith in what's going on, if you think rebirth is a reasonable proposition and you can believe in that, that's fine. But if you don't have enough faith and you don't, then it's good to inquire to find out, well, maybe there's something I haven't understood here. And also sometimes people will challenge you. If you believe in rebirth, particularly in the West, this happens to me a lot all the time. They say, how can you believe in rebirth? Isn't that just superstition or something? And of course, when people say these kind of things to you, well, then you're going to have some good answers. Otherwise, they will kind of blow you away, and you will start thinking, well, maybe they have a point. Maybe there isn't any rebirth. So you actually have to figure this out for yourself in a way that you can stand your ground and you can defend that position of rebirth. And it's not that difficult to defend the position of rebirth. There is a lot of scientific evidence even that there is such a thing as rebirth. And it's important to know that there are areas where science itself hasn't yet discovered the reality of things. And rebirth is probably one area where it's fair to say that science doesn't really have that much to say about it. So that's why I think it's perfectly permissible to believe in it, and yet say that we also take science, scientific facts also on board. Does that answer your question? Yeah? Okay.
I think there are two prominent psychiatrists though who have done some work in this area. Dr. Ian Stevenson, University of Virginia, that you can read his research on rebirth. And Brian Wise, yeah. Many lives, many masters, right? And I think many, many more. So you can actually do a Google on Amazon.com, and there are plenty of books on rebirth.
How you look into your past lives, okay. I think the only really reliable way of doing it is through meditation practice. So first of all, you have to have a mind which is very powerful, extraordinarily still. And that was basically what I was just talking about, the life of the Buddha before. You have to get into this very powerful states of meditation when the mind is so still and so peaceful that it has enough power to be able to do these kind of things. So the first thing is just to keep practicing until you achieve deep states of samadhi, deep states of concentration, of stillness, and then you have the possibility. Anything prior to that is going to be uncertain. So I must say that some of the research done by somebody like Dr. Ian Stevenson of the University of Virginia, he just died about a year ago, is very powerful when you read that. Because he shows you, he looked into the lives of children, for example, children who claim to recall past lives. And then he verified that claim with actually what existed around them. He looked to that village where they said they were reborn. He looked to the people that they were talking about, the buildings they were talking about. And he verified that a lot of these stories, there was practically no way of explaining how they could have this recollection unless it actually was a past life experience. Very powerful. And I know many people who have read these kind of books, they have said, yes, well, rebirth seems to be the only explanation. But because many people are so skeptical, they say, I still can't accept it. So that is what often happens. Because your skepticism is more powerful than your common sense, then this is what can happen sometimes. My personal experience of rebirth. Okay. There's several problems with that question. And the first, the main problem is that as a monk, you're not allowed to even talk about these things. That is the main problem there. But you can take it that, there are people out there, there are monks out there who I've personally met, who claim to remember their past lives. So there is, you know, as far as I'm concerned, there's no doubt that this is actually a reality. This is the way things are. But as far as for myself, I can't really tell. But you can take it, generally speaking, that there's only a very small minority, even among monks, who have actually gotten to the stage of recalling past lives. So usually, you can assume that when you meet somebody, that they have not recalled these things. That's the usual assumption you can make. But there will be exceptional people. And usually the way you can decide whether they are exceptional or not is just to watch somebody. Watch their general spiritual qualities and watch it over a long time. And if somebody comes across as particularly wise and having particularly strong spiritual qualities, and you can see it over a long time, that is where you're going to find the people who actually have recalled their past lives. So you can never be sure, because no monk is ever going to tell you that I've recalled my past lives. And if they do, then you should be even more skeptical. But that is basically the only answer I can give you on that one.
Ajahn, I think I heard Ajahn Brown one time. He mentioned that in Australia, they are experimenting with the hypnotism and going back to the past life to cure certain things, you know. And then the other case you mentioned about Dr. Ian Stevenson with his team, they have experiment with 2,600 cases to prove the cases. So I have a question, Ajahn Brown. You mentioned about enjoyment, you know, that time when we enjoy ourselves, we forget that we will die one day. You know, there's death coming. And on the other hand, when we are talking about suffering, you know, death is suffering, birth is suffering, stress, sickness and so forth are suffering. Then when we focus on the truth about suffering, the truth on death, don't you think we can go crazy too? So where do we balance ourselves to, you know, to approach that way?
Okay, that's a very good question. Because sometimes when people think about death and think about all these things, it doesn't actually lead to anything positive. It leads to maybe they start to feel a bit funny and feel it's very difficult to think about these things. It's a very important point. And the way that you can decide whether anything is beneficial for you in the spiritual life, whether it's meditation, whether it is recalling death or recalling suffering or defilements or whatever it is, it also always has to lead to something positive. And people came to me yesterday and asked me, well, what sort of meditation should I do? And they were talking about all these kind of other meditations, which I don't know much about. But the point of meditation is that it's supposed to make you peaceful, make you feel good inside. If meditation makes you feel confused, if it makes you feel a bit funny, if it makes you go a little bit crazy or whatever, then be very careful, because that is not what it's supposed to do to you. It's supposed to make you feel good. It's not going to be blissful every time you meditate. Sometimes it's going to be feel a little bit tense maybe, sometimes it's going to feel sleepy, sometimes it's going to feel restless, sometimes it's going to be not so nice. But it certainly shouldn't make you more confused or make you feel crazy. In the long run, you should see a progression where meditation makes you feel much better about yourself, much more peaceful, and much more happiness in your mind. And that is really the advice for all kinds of spiritual practice. It should be going, bringing you in the right direction. That is the bottom line. If it does that, then you know that you're doing something which is wholesome. You should feel peaceful, you should feel at ease, you should feel good about yourself. You shouldn't be getting more and more confused, more and more kind of disturbed. If you do that, then be very careful.
So, in another word, can we say that we take the middle path instead of the extremity of focusing on the horror of death, or just enjoy yourself?
It's a skillful balance when you think about death. It's about not thinking about the horror of death at all. It's about just realizing that death is part of life. If you're born, you're going to die. And unless you come to terms with this now, well, you're going to have to come to terms with it at some stage. The less you have come to terms with the fact of death, the more of a shock it's going to be when it eventually happens. So if you already can sort of internalize that idea that you're going to die straight away, then when it happens, you can take it more easy. It won't be such a shock for you. That's the point. That's the whole purpose of this.
Thank you. I just have, in the past, I faced almost death 5 times.
Okay.
So I realized what you're saying.
Good.
I mean, going on with what the gentleman just said, could you share with us near-death karma, for example, like thoughts, if something like that were to happen, maybe you could share with us.
What exactly do you mean by near-death karma?
Oh, for example, before a person dies, maybe a person should be thinking about certain things.
It's a good point. The most important point in life is not actually what you do when you die. That can be a little bit helpful, what you do when you die. But the most important thing in life is to make sure that you do a lot of goodness throughout your life, that you have a very strong foundation, a habitual goodness inside of you. That is much, much more important, because that habitual goodness is what in the long run is going to make sure that you reap happy results in the long run. So what happens at the moment you die, it may have a short-term consequence for you after you die. For example, if you happen to die when you're really, really angry, for example, that might have a negative consequence. But the point is that even though that might have a negative consequence, it's only going to be very short-term, because your general attitude, your general way of being is one of goodness. So the ideal way of helping somebody when they're about to die, and if you want to sort of maximize the chances of a good rebirth, is to help them out by reminding them of the goodness in their lives, saying things to them which brings up a sense of peace and happiness, because that peaceful and happy mind is a mind which is going to go to a good rebirth.
I'm just going to pass this emceeing to Brother Ong, because I have to go down and meet the Minister, Senior Minister of State, Mr. Iswaran, who will be coming to join the Vesak celebration. So he'll be coming into this hall about 11:45. So in the meantime, you've got lots of opportunities to ask lots of questions.
Okay, any more questions from the floor? Just raise your hand, I'll pass you the mic. If you're right behind, I'll throw you the mic. Still thinking?
I have read the book of Past Life of Buddha. It seems that all his past life he was living in India. Is it true?
Yeah, it's a good question, and certainly the kind of question which I also ask, because this is what you, when you read things and you see something which looks a bit strange, it's actually good to bring it up. And I think the point is that what you have to remember is that when the Buddha was teaching the Dhamma to his followers, he was teaching to his monks and nuns and also to the lay followers, he had to speak in a way that they would understand. So he would always speak in terms of the culture of India at the time. So for example, the classical story I talked about before, where the Buddha was named Jotipala and he had a friend named Gatikara, well, he called himself a Brahmin, right? So you may wonder, well, were the Brahmins also in the past lives? So was everything exactly the same? And I think the point there is that the Buddha is saying that this person was somebody of high standing, somebody of a high caste, somebody of a high social position in India. And that is essentially what he is saying. And the way to explain that to an Indian audience is to say that he was a Brahmin. Because that's how they would actually relate to it. So I think the point is that he just making it possible for people around to understand what he's talking about. He has to use, if you like, the reference points that were common at that time in India. He couldn't sort of explain something which was completely different. So sometimes people ask, well, is it possible for a Buddha to arise in our modern age? Do we have too much technology for the Buddha, for example? Is there too much indulgence in our modern age for a Buddha to be able to arise in the world? And I think the answer is no. They can probably be a Buddha at any time. And of course, a Buddha who arose at this time, he would use a different language and different way of talking about things because of our modern understanding and our modern day of doing things. The internet, right? The Buddha, maybe his talks would be on the internet as well. That would be nice, wouldn't it? Having the Buddha's talks on the internet. That would be something special.
Thanks, Ajahn, for the sharing. There's one more question over here.
Hi, I'm actually very ignorant of Buddha or Buddhism. Yeah. Earlier, you were talking about Buddha's life as before he was Buddha, as a human being, right? Now, I was wondering if you could elaborate a bit more about his emotional life. What was he like emotionally? I mean, did he say very much of it?
The problem is that. The Buddha doesn't go into any great details about himself before he was enlightened. He doesn't talk a lot about it. And those stories that I mentioned before, that's pretty much all you've got from the Buddha talking about himself in the past life. So you don't really have to ask so much about the emotional life, because what you find is that human beings are pretty much the same everywhere. You know, we all have some people are maybe a little bit less angry, some people are a bit more angry, some people have a bit more calm and peace in them, some people have a bit less calm and peace. But we all have the same mind states every now and again. We all have desires, we all have angers, we all have times when we feel peaceful, we all have times when we feel compassion for other people. So we all have this whole range of emotions and mind states within us. And that was one of the things I wanted to point out, was that the Buddha himself had defilements, but defilements in Buddhism, the most important defilement is ill will, anger. This is the most problematic defilement in human beings. And he says quite clearly that he also had those defilements in his life. So there's no doubt, he doesn't go into any great detail. It isn't really necessary to go into detail, because we know what that means already. You happy with that? Okay.
Thanks, Ajahn. Any more questions from the floor? Ajahn is going back to Perth, so you don't have an email. So if you want to ask questions, now's the right time to do so.
Ajahn, I'm more interested in the present life. Of what use to me? How does it benefit my this life? If I knew that in the past I was a great womanizer or a very powerful prince or beggar or something, it's interesting, but actually I was warned, be careful, you may not like what you see. So my point is, how useful it is to know my past life in relevance to the present life.
It is incredibly useful. Extraordinarily, extraordinarily useful. That was one of the points I was trying to make. It is absolutely super significant. But you are very right. You have one very good point there, which I think is important to mention. If you do recall your past life, usually it's not going to be what you think it is. You're not going to be a king. You're not going to be somebody who... You're not going to be Cleopatra or something like that. And because very often this is what people think. They go to some kind of a therapist or something, somebody who's going to show them their past lives. And they get told, oh, you were this wonderful person in the past life. If you get told that you were a kind of peasant working in the fields all your life, and then you died an early death because you got killed in a war at the age of 45, well, then maybe that's a true memory of past life. So past life usually is going to be very ordinary, a very kind of not very interesting. And that is precisely the point of recalling past lives. Because when you start to understand... thank you. You can look after like a baby here. It's very nice. So you start to understand the problem with the samsara. And that's why it is so interesting, you know. And this is sometimes when I think about it. Well, what would it be like to recall my past lives? Just as a kind of thought experiment. And you realize that you have been doing the same thing again and again and again. You've been growing up, going through the problems of being a child and being a young person. Thousands of times, millions of times, again and again. And every time you get back, you do the same mistakes. You argue with your parents. You don't like going to school and all these things. Then you become a parent yourself. And now you have the suffering of having children yourself. And you want your children to do the right thing, but they don't, because you didn't do the right thing when you were a child, you know. And samsara kind of perpetuates itself in this way. And when you see that, you get this incredible aversion against rebirth. You don't want to have anything to do with it. And this is the power, this is the tremendous power of understanding your past life. You get so much negativity towards this, that is what propels you to actually practice the path to its full extent and become fully awakened. I don't think it's possible to realize how off-putting being reborn is until you actually see it for yourself. Only then do you understand how terrible it actually is. And then you start to understand these things. The other thing, of course, is in Buddhism, not only do we believe in rebirth as human beings, we also believe in rebirth as gods, of great possible happiness. Not gods in the sense of other religions, but in terms of powerful beings. But you also believe in rebirth in realms of even more suffering than human beings. You know, imagine getting reborn as an animal, as an insect, as a mosquito or something. Would you like to be a mosquito? I mean, somebody gets upset with you for 1 second because you're sucking their blood, and they just slap you and you're dead. And then you have a thousand lives like that. I mean, after a while, you get pretty fed up with that. Being a mosquito, being an insect, is no joke. It is basically a terrible life. It is full of suffering, full of problems. So this is the kind of thing, you reflect in that way, you get a little bit of, I better do a little bit of spiritual practice in my life. That is the purpose of remembering your past life.
Thank you, Ajahn.